Last week's text covered the need for and the birth of a deliverer for the people of Israel from the bondage of Egypt. Today, as we continue the story, we will be looking at Exodus 2:11 through 4:17. These verses cover Moses' escape to Midian and God's call of Moses to go back to deliver the people. This commission comes from one of the most famous scenes in the Bible, the burning bush. As we work through these verses, I'm going to use them as an opportunity to discuss the genre of biblical history or narrative in general, because there are a lot of things as we go through these verses that serve as great examples of some general characteristics that would be really good to keep in mind and be very helpful for us to know as we continue through this book, and honestly as you look to narrative or history in general throughout the Bible. I also am aware that Caleb just did a series called Tell Me Your Story on biblical narrative last summer. We just spoke about it a bit this morning. So sorry if some of it is repetitive, but again, I know that this is going to be helpful for us to keep in mind as we continue to work through these stories. The biggest thing to know, first and foremost, about biblical narratives are that they are thematic and didactic. This means that they aren't just stories for the sake of a story, or written just for dry historical notes. They are arranged and written with a purpose. They will have recurring ideas and themes that connect and develop within a single story, and because it is one grand story, these ideas and themes will also connect and develop across many stories, in fact, all stories. Kurt mentioned a couple of them already today with connections between Moses and Jesus. You'll see a lot of those between Moses and Jesus. It's kind of on purpose. I'm going to do a whole sermon on it Christmas Day. And as we think about this, we also need to realize that these stories, as beautifully woven together as they are, even this is not the point. They are meant to teach us. They are meant to teach us primarily about God, his unfolding plan, and how we are to respond to him, how we are to live. We see such historical narrative style that has themes and development and purpose, even today in many biographies. But for us, this is usually indicated through the title. If you look up biographies of George Washington, and I literally did for this, you will see titles such as George Washington, A Life from Beginning to End, The Spiritual Journey of George Washington, General George Washington, A Military Life, or George Washington, Entrepreneur, How Our Founding Fathers' Private Business Pursuits Changed America and the World. That one, last one is very specific. These titles clearly indicate to us what is the purpose or theme of the book. So we are not surprised when certain events or even time periods are skipped. We are also not surprised when certain things are given much more attention in one telling of a story than they are in another. Think the Gospels. We are given the theme in our modern English Bible with the title Exodus. But the original title in Hebrew was actually simply the first couple words, which meant these are the names of. It was the common practice in the day to title books after their opening word or phrase. The modern title is correct, however, for the major theme of the book is obviously the exodus of the people of Israel from Egypt and the covenant they enter with God at Mount Sinai after he delivers them. This theme explains why Moses' entire childhood, and apparently, as we see in Acts 7, the first 40 years of his life is skipped. This is what just happened in our jump from last week's text to this week's text. If you look at chapter 1, verse 8 through 14, and then you look at chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, like basically 1 and 2, the beginning of 1, you have this like giant recap of how we got there, and then by the end of 2:10, you have gotten to the birth of Moses, and then all of a sudden in 2:11, one day when Moses had grown up. Like we skip significant time periods. That is on purpose. As fascinating as it would be for us to know what it was like for Moses to grow up in Pharaoh's household, we are given zero information about that, because that is not the point. It would be certainly fascinating history to us, but again, the point of the stories in the Bible is not just dry historical notes to answer all of the curiosities and questions that we have. There is a purposeful developing theme and connection of ideas, and there is a purpose to how the story is being told. So Caleb mentioned one of the things that I wanted to bring up about biblical narrative, and that's when stuff is weird or just seems off to us, we should pause and think about why it seems off to us. When entire periods of time are skipped, we should pause and be like, well, why was that skipped? And usually the answer is, because that's not the point. As interesting as some of that stuff would be, that's not the point of what is being told and how it's being told. This is also why we aren't even given Moses' age when things are happening until chapter 7, when we read that he is 80 years old and that Aaron is 83. We will discuss more in January when we get to these chapters. But for now, I will just say that his age is given there as part of an overall introduction to the plagues that emphasize that God, not Moses, is the one who is going to deliver the people. Moses is just the vessel. His age is mentioned at that time because in that day, just as in today, to be 80 years old, one was expected to be well into retirement, not beginning a great work. So giving the age of Moses and Aaron further emphasizes that this is God delivering the people through human vessels, but this is ultimately God's deliverance. The thematic purpose of the verse, of the book, also explains why the storyline isn't always strictly chronological. We're not going to see this too much today, but we will see it as the book develops. And when we hit these times where the storyline seems like, well, didn't that happen already? Or like, what happened there? Like, we're going to hit some of that, and I'll point that out as we go. And those are places where people who are into like literary criticism and historical criticism of the Bible will be like, well, see here, that there's like an error in the Bible. I would argue that that's not allowing the genre to be what it is and holding the genre of biblical narrative history to standards that we are artificially imposing from our modern viewpoint and not allowing this genre, this story, to be what it is. When events are put slightly out of chronological order or even largely out of chronological order for a time, it is not because the author didn't know that. In fact, he's usually well aware of it, but it's because he is making a point. There are things called anachronisms where it's like things are mentioned where it's like that doesn't exist yet. And part of that is, one, you have to realize that like this book, like the people were wandering, they were being delivered, like they didn't have time to be writing this stuff down at the time. So like a lot of this stuff is written a ways after the fact, like when things have calmed down a little bit. So we have to realize that some things like are easy to say looking back. But then also when things like that happen, there's a reason for that. And it's, again, not that there's an error made or even just an error of judgment. There's usually a purpose, and we'll get there as we run across some of them. And by the way, this is still seen today in modern storytelling. The thing that came to mind immediately is, like, I would argue, way overused thing right now, where movies start with, like, something near the end, and then all of a sudden they flash back and, like, 3 years earlier, or, like, the beginning of that day, and then they start going forward. And, like, it baffles me at times to read commentaries or critiques of the Bible where they're imposing standards that we don't enforce even today. It's like we allow modern stories to play fast and loose sometimes with the timeline, but all of a sudden the Bible does, and we're like, oh, that's an error. Like, guys, we still do that. So I just kind of want to point out some of these things as we go. And part of it also is to put some tools in your belt also as you encounter some critiques of the Bible. Because that is one that is out there and is fairly common, where like all these timeline things are like, well, the Bible's full of errors because timelines and stuff like that. It's like, well, there's actually usually a reason, and pretty much always a reason, why the timeline is the way it is, and it's because of how the story is being told. Where the story picks up, getting back to Exodus chapter 2, verse 11, where the story picks up, in a sense, is the inauguration of the work of Moses. Notice that even here, there is a purposeful theme and foreshadowing of what is to come and what events are told and how they are told. I'm not going to reread it because we just had it read as the scripture reading, but just kind of follow along and think about what I'm saying as you look at the events again in the verses, and specifically looking at the rest of chapter 2, so verses 11 through 25 at the end. And again, where the story picks up, we've skipped from his birth and we're now he's older. We're picking up at what could be said as the inauguration of his work. The first thing to notice is that 2:11 to 25 focus on three key events that demonstrate that Moses is a man who seeks justice and seeks to liberate the oppressed. There are three key action times in these verses. The first one is when he strikes down the Egyptian who was beating a Hebrew. The second one, immediately following it, is when he then confronts a Hebrew who struck a fellow Hebrew. And then later on, towards the end of the chapter, you see that he saves some shepherd girls from harassment by some other shepherds. The text kind of slows down at these things, and like his whole journey from Egypt to Midian, that whole flight there is just like skip, and we pause again when he is saving some shepherd girls. So there's a purposeful speed up, slow down that happens, and it's all around these three key events. Such a purposeful grouping of events to highlight someone's character or to teach something about them or about what God is doing is very common in biblical narrative, especially the Gospels, where the acts of Jesus are often grouped together or presented in a pattern, which gets back to the chronological thing, because sometimes you have events of Jesus portrayed in different timelines in different Gospels, and usually it's because his types of actions are being grouped or being presented in a pattern. The second thing to notice is that these three events foreshadow something that will happen later in the life of Moses. He struck the Egyptian impulsively and had to flee from the land due to his action. Later in his life, he impulsively strikes a rock rather than speaking to it as God commands and isn't allowed into the promised land because of his defiance of God before the people. When he confronts the two Hebrews, he is sarcastically called a prince and a judge when he tries to arbitrate. They do not accept his judgment over them. Later, he does become a judge, literally a judge over the people, but oftentimes his authority and judgment is questioned. The third thing that happens is that he saves the shepherd girls from attack by a source of water, a well, and then provides water for them by feeding their flocks. Later, God, through Moses, leads the people away from an attack by the Egyptians, by the Red Sea, by a source of water, and then after the Song of Moses, the next thing we read is that he provides water for them on their journey. I don't think it's an accident that the specific details that are given and pointed out and narrated in these events of Moses are echoed almost exactly in later events in the life of Moses. I do not think that is an accident. Such foreshadowing demonstrates that biblical narrative should be read like thematic biography, or even, I'm going to caveat what I'm about to say, even like fiction in a way. Obviously, I'm not trying to say that the story is fiction, but what I'm saying and what I mean is that stories are written in such a way that a close reading will reveal patterns, repetitions, themes, motifs, and Chekhov's guns. This doesn't mean that the events are not true. It just means that which events and which details are included and how they are told has been done so on purpose and with a purpose. This should not surprise us because we still write this way today. And back when the Bible was being written down, writing things down and preserving them was much more labor-intensive than it is today. So you did not include details that were not necessary. In fact, one of the literary things I mentioned was Chekhov's gun. If you broaden out the principle, basically the principle of Chekhov's gun means that if a detail is not intrinsic or necessary for the story, you do not write it. Which, if more authors followed that, there'd be a lot longer stories would be a lot shorter. But that's like the strictest definition of the principle. And that's actually what you see in the Bible. And I would argue a large part of that is because simply the process of writing down and preserving documents, everything included has to be important. For example, if we read in the Bible that somebody has long hair, it's probably going to be important to the storyline somehow that they had long hair. And we see this a lot in the story of Moses and all throughout Exodus and biblical narrative. There are many more connections with other biblical stories that are seen here in these verses. But for now, for the sake of time, I want to go back to the first event and briefly discuss something else that we see and that is common in biblical narrative. Because God is always the main character, the Bible is not shy about pointing out flaws in people. We spent a lot of time about this actually just in Sunday school today. The Bible is not shy about pointing out flaws, even in prominent people. God is not endorsing every action, but he is working through it. He is accomplishing his perfect plan even through imperfect vessels. A lot of what we read in scripture is therefore descriptive, not prescriptive. What I mean by that is it is simply telling something how it happened, not necessarily telling us that we should go out and do likewise. Rather than feeling like we need to justify every action of the people in the Bible and set them up on a pedestal as an example to follow, we should be looking to see what God is doing through them, despite their imperfections. A lot of ink has been spilled trying to justify Moses' killing of the Egyptian, saying that it was an accident or that it was done in defense of a man being killed and therefore justified. Or I even read one commentator who said that because he was the future deliverer, he was already acting in the role of deliverer and dealing out God's justice and acting in the place of God. There's a lot of ink that's been spilled, a lot of circles and interpretive loops that have been jumped through to try to justify and explain fully what's going on. The issue, though, is that we are not given enough details to know for sure what exactly was the specifics, the characteristics, and the motive of Moses in really any of these three events. The verb that is used for strike or beat is the same exact word that is used when the Egyptian hits the Hebrew, when the Hebrew hits the Hebrew, and when Moses hits the Egyptian. It's the same exact word in all three instances without any clarification. So we aren't given the motive behind it or even the intensity behind it. We do know, however, from events later in the life of Moses that he struggles with anger and to act impulsively, and he tends to overreact at times. So rather than trying to find a way to perfectly explain and justify this, we should see it, whether right or wrong, as Moses clearly choosing to identify with his people rather than with the Egyptians, and showing himself to be someone who cares about and fights for the oppressed, whether or not he always does that in the perfect way. Because that's his life going forward. He makes mistakes more than just this time. And again, we don't know exactly what was going on with the Egyptian and the Hebrew. We don't know if there would have been a better way for Moses to handle it. But the Bible just doesn't give us all those details. And honestly, it doesn't need to all the time. Because again, the point of the story is not Moses. Moses is not being put up on a pedestal. God is. To get back to the flow of the narrative in 2:11 through 22, we see that Moses is rejected by both the Egyptians and his people and flees to Midian, where he finds a home with the priest there and ends up marrying one of the priest's daughters. The chapter then ends by reminding us of the plight of the Israelites in Egypt and of God's compassion for them. God heard, saw, knew, and is about to act on their behalf. We also read that the Pharaoh who wanted to kill Moses died sometime during Moses' time in Midian, and that the people are still in slavery. It was normal practice at this time for a new pharaoh to pardon criminals condemned by the previous ruler, to release prisoners and free slaves. Exodus 4:19 confirms that this transition of leadership meant that Moses was not still condemned by the leadership in Egypt. But we read here that the people are still under grueling bondage. It was potentially a time where they may have thought that this new leadership may have freed them, and that was not the case. So I think what we see here at the end of chapter 2 is that their groaning is redoubled and that they are now newly under oppression because there's new leadership that has chosen to still keep them under bondage. This practice also helps us to understand why this detail of the death of the Pharaoh immediately precedes a description of God's compassion for his people and the account of God's commissioning Moses to go back and deliver the people, as we are about to see in the account of the burning bush. Deliverance is not going to come from a new Pharaoh. Deliverance is going to come from God. This itself also gives us another characteristic of biblical narratives. The story often assumes a lot of cultural assumption and knowledge that we may or may not have. This connection here between the death of the Pharaoh, the redoubling of the groaning of the Israelites, and God's commission to Moses to go free them, that connection there wouldn't have really been needed to explain. But I didn't even know about this connection until I started doing a bunch of research about what's going on in the flow of the narrative here. This is another norm of biblical narrative, and really the Bible in general. It was written a long time ago in another culture. It was written in a way that anyone, obviously once it's translated, anyone can understand many things, especially the big picture and what is required to be saved. But there are many particulars and many extra layers that only study can reveal. If everything was explained fully, the book would be, one, way too big. But then also, due to the constraints of language, it is impossible to say something at one time and place that will perfectly translate to all cultures of all times without any need of any explanation at all. We may be frustrated by this, but it is actually part of God's grace that he gave his revelation in human language. The fact that God revealed his truth in a time and place and that it was written down means that, yes, we do have some work of translation and interpretation and study, but it also means that God revealed himself. So it may be frustrating at times, but it is part of the glorious truth of the fact that God wants us to know about him. We might have some work to do, but we get to know about God. So it's a two-edged sword. Jumping back to the narrative, let's pick up in Exodus 3. This is one of the most familiar scenes in the Bible, the burning bush. There are, however, actually only three things that I would like to focus on, mostly for the sake of time. There's a lot of really cool stuff that I wish I had time to get into, but my notes were getting way too long. So here, as always, if you have questions or stuff that I don't bring up, one, I might bring it up in later sermons, but keep it in mind, keep it as a question. If you submit to me like soon and I know it's coming, I might just tell you that, be like, hey, wait till this chapter, and then I'll get to it. But anyways, so getting back to the narrative, there are three things I want to focus on. And before I do that, I should probably read it. So the text that we're going to be looking at is Exodus 3, 1 to 14, 7. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Then he said, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place in which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their suffering. And I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He said, but I will be with you, and this will be a sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. When Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered through all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt. And I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. And they will listen to your voice, and you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Now please, let us go on a 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless he is compelled with a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders that I will do in it. And after that, he will let you go. And I will give the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go out, you shall not be empty. But each woman shall ask of her neighbor and any woman who lives in her house for silver and gold jewelry and clothing. And you shall put them on your sons and your daughters, so you shall plunder the Egyptians. Then Moses answered, but behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, the Lord did not appear to you. The Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And he said, a staff. And he said, throw it on the ground. So he threw it on the ground and it became a serpent. And Moses ran from it. And the Lord said to Moses, put out your hand and catch it by the tail. So he put out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. That they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Again, the Lord said, put your hand inside your cloak. And he put his hand inside his cloak. And when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then God said, put your hand back inside your cloak. So he put it back inside his cloak. And when he took it out, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. If they will not believe you, God said, or listen to the first sign, then they may believe the latter sign. And if they will not believe even these two signs, or listen to your voice, you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and the water that you shall take from the Nile shall become blood on the dry ground. But Moses said to the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue. Then the Lord said to him, who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, therefore, and I will be with your mouth and will teach you what to speak. But he said, Oh, my Lord, please send someone else. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, Is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. Behold, he is coming out to meet you, and when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you both what to do. He shall speak for you to the people. He shall be your mouth, and you shall be as God to him. And take in your hand this staff, with which you shall do signs. I know this is, again, one of the more familiar accounts in the Bible. And as I went, you may have noticed that I purposely inflected and added a little bit of character to some of what was being said. Part of why I did that, I'm going to get to, and some of the things that we're going to talk about. And I honestly, in my research for this, went back and watched the burning bush scene from the Prince of Egypt and from the Ten Commandments. I'm going to point out some things that are different, because I'm kind of assuming that most of us are fairly familiar with those kind of staples in our culture. The first thing, though, that I want to consider may seem like a weird question, but the first thing I want to consider is who is speaking from the bush. It may sound like a really obvious question, but actually it's a little bit more complicated than you might think. We are told in verse 2, so if you look back to 3, verse 2, we are told that the angel of the Lord appeared to Moses in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. And as you follow the description of Moses' approach to the burning bush, it seems that he saw the flames from a distance and noticed that the bush was not burning. But then as he came close, he heard God tell him to not come near. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Was he afraid to look at the fire? The one speaking to Moses calls himself the Lord, God, and the I Am. So it is easy to forget about the angel and think that the voice of God is coming from the fire, as portrayed in the Prince of Egypt and the Ten Commandments. The problem with this is that Acts 7:35 specifically says that God sent Moses by the hand of the angel. And later in Exodus 23:21, we read that God the Father says that his name, which in the Bible terminology, name means essence, usually, his essence is in this angel. We also clearly see in other scriptures as well that this angel is said to be Yahweh. In Leviticus 11:45, Joshua 24:17-18, Judges 2:1, these passages interchange the angel and Yahweh as the one who brought the people out of Egypt and led them. We also see throughout Exodus and the verses mentioned that God is said to send the angel, but that also that the angel is said to be God. There's a lot of weird overlap. If you look for passages that refer to the angel of the Lord throughout the Old Testament, you will notice a pattern of a visibly present and tangible angel that claims to be God, acts and speaks as God, and accepts or even expects, as here, to be worshipped. This is because here in Exodus 3, and in Genesis, which I wish I had time to go into, but I don't, but here in Exodus 3, we see the second person of the Godhead, described as the angel of the Lord, later born as Christ. But we see this second person of the Godhead, our future Emmanuel, Redeemer, here, commissioning a prototype deliverer. The second thing I want to focus on is a much discussed question, and that is, what does this name, this Yahweh name, mean? There are some difficulties about the meaning, form, pronunciation, tense, language of origin, even influenced by other languages, about this name. We do not even know, honestly, for sure, how the divine name was originally pronounced. Because, pardon the grammar slash original languages excursus here, but as far as like the history of this Yahweh name and as it's written down, the earliest manuscripts actually have the vowels for the Hebrew word, the name, overlaid over Yahweh, which name is Shema. So it's just Yahweh is how they pronounce it originally. But that wasn't the pronunciation, because there's actually scribal notes in there that, like, they're overlaying the vowels of the name on there. And then later manuscripts overlay the vowels of Adonai, or Lord, on there. Which, by the way, this is where we get the pronunciation Jehovah, is from that overlay of the vowels of Lord or Adonai on top of Yahweh. So that's actually an artificial word Which, I mean, it's still a word that was used, but it's definitely not like the original name or the original pronunciation. But there has been a history of changing the pronunciation and purposely pronouncing a artificial pronunciation of the name. This tradition is likely due to the fact that that name giving became viewed in the ancient world as a way of wielding power over one named. So they purposefully mispronounced the name to not be seen as committing heresy or to be viewed as trying to manipulate God. It was a purposeful mispronunciation to not pronounce the divine name. The current pronunciation, if you're curious, Yahweh, comes from the fact that the shortened form that is seen at times in the Hebrew Bible is just the first part, the YH, pronounced as Yah. If this matches the original pronunciation of the shortened form, which we don't even know that, but if it matches the original pronunciation, then according to the rules of Hebrew grammar, the next vowel should be an I-class vowel, which we'll explain that later if you want, but it basically the full form would be Yahweh. So basically what they're doing is like, well, we have a short form here that starts with A, so according to the rules of grammar, we have to finish it with Yahweh. But again, even that's a guess because we don't know if the short form was the original pronunciation. So all that to say, there are just a lot of complications. Another big thing that often goes unnoticed is that God actually gives two forms of his name, Ehyeh and Yahweh. First person, I am, Ehyeh, which basically I'm Americanizing that. But then the third person, he is Yahweh. The third person form, Yahweh, is the more well-known one and the one used primarily in the Bible going forward. But God actually answers first the first person form when Moses asks, who are you? He says, I am that I am. He says, tell the Israelites, I am has sent you. And then he switches to the third person, or he is. And we'll get there a little bit. But the I am, if you track its presence throughout the Bible, I am almost exclusively comes from the mouth of God, or later, from Jesus. When we say God's name, we use the third person, he is, which again is part of the whole name calling, having being seen as having power or wielding control over a deity. There is no association with us in any way manipulating God or having any sort of control over him. And that's built into how the name itself is revealed. Another interesting thing to note is that Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, is actually the full title that he wants to be remembered forever. That's specifically stated in verse 15, is that that whole phrase is what he wants remembered. Another interesting note is that in Exodus 34:14, we read, the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. The form of the word Yahweh, due to its unique spelling and the fact that there are some grammar and language of origin and language of influence complications, the word itself could be influenced by an Arabic root that would have been familiar in the land of Midian and to Moses that means love, desire, or passion. It would have been translated, therefore, as the jealous or the impassioned one or the one who loves. This would tie directly into his revelation as himself as a covenant God of Moses' fathers. The possibility of an Arabic influence is also reinforced by the fact that the word for bush is influenced by an Arabic root as well. So when we combine all of these difficulties and possibilities, I think it might make more sense to follow the order of God's revelation of his name and see the I am, the Ehyeh as his name, and that he revealed to Moses, but that he chooses to be known as a he is, or as a connection with love, or like he has the list of all the God, I am the God of your fathers. He chooses to be known by his relationships and by what he does. Which gets a little bit into the whole third person thing, because there's a possible Arabic root thing, but if you the Yahweh, the shortened form being Yah, like the rules of grammar have that being a causative stem, which means that he is the God who causes to be. So like there are all sorts of possible meanings and implications about the name, but if you actually track as God reveals himself here, you see actually four times that God says, I am the God of your fathers, God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And then later in chapter 6, when he is revealing his name again, and he says, I didn't reveal myself to the patriarchs like this, but I revealed myself to you like this. I am, he uses the Yahweh there and opens up a section of like three verses that closes, it opens and closes with Yahweh, and in between is all the things he is about to do for his people. That is part of his revelation of his name. God chooses to be known for his covenantal relationships and his faithfulness. So I know there's a lot of discussion that goes around about the divine name and how to pronounce it, what it means, I think we'd be better off focusing on the fact that God consistently throughout the Bible chooses to be known by his covenant relationships and faithfulness, and that what we know of him and how he has chosen to act, and that we are called to have faith in him and be part of that relationship, that is what's most important. The last thing I would like to look at is what we can learn from the exchange between Moses and God. We can learn much about God's patience and grace from the exchange between Moses and God. And I try to convey this a little bit in how I read it. You'll notice that I didn't really include much anger or yelling in how I read the account. If you watch portrayals of the burning bush, God sometimes yells a lot, which is interesting because we aren't even told that his anger was kindled until the very last question. But some portrayals have him angry the whole time. As soon as Moses starts asking questions, God's angry. That's not what we see in the Bible. So I want us to look more closely at what's actually happening with this exchange between God and Moses. First, notice how God introduces himself. He introduces himself at the beginning of chapter 3 as the God of Moses' ancestors, as a familial God. He was with his fathers. Next, he introduces himself as the God who cares and has come to help. He is the God who has seen, heard, and knows the suffering of his people and has come down to deliver them and bring them up out of the land into a good land. This language, by the way, of God coming down is seen elsewhere in the Tower of Babel and also in Sodom and Gomorrah. It is God coming down in judgment. And as also we saw with Lot, God delivering his people from that judgment. I don't think that phrase, I have come down, and then its direct connection with those other two events is something that's done on accident. In verse 11, we see that Moses declares that he feels himself inadequate for the task. God comforts him by telling him that he will be with him and will give him a sign. In verse 13, Moses then asks what name of God he should give to convince the people that their God has sent him. God graciously answers by giving his name and affirming his relationship to their fathers. He also tells Moses to comfort them that God has seen their suffering and will deliver them. In 18 to 22, God goes on to tell Moses that Pharaoh will not listen, but that God will respond by demonstrating his power and would make Pharaoh let them go. He further promised that the people of Egypt would even willingly give the people silver and gold and clothing in a sort of reversal of fortune and recompense for their uncompensated slave labor. In chapter 4, 1 through 9, Moses responds that the people may not believe that God had appeared to him, or by implication, given him the message. We may see this as an excuse. But Moses' attempt to help the two Hebrews before he fled to Midian was met with hostility, and a people enslaved for so long would surely be wary of false hope. So I don't think this is Moses just being angsty at this point. These are legitimate questions that he's bringing to God, that he wants answered in his own heart as he goes to accomplish this mission. God answers this response by giving Moses signs to prove to the people that God indeed did send him with this message. There's lots of cool stuff with the signs, by the way. I didn't have time today. We'll get there later. In verse 10, Moses declares that he is slow of speech and of tongue. Elsewhere in Exodus, he describes himself as being of uncircumcised lips. It is very likely, based on these descriptions, that Moses either had a speech impediment or that maybe he was just not confident in his own fluency and power of speech, specifically in Egyptian, which would be important because he's about to go speak before Pharaoh, which would potentially be the uncircumcised lips things, like uncircumcised lips in the view of Pharaoh, because the uncircumcised lips is usually in the context of, like, I'm about to go to speak to Pharaoh, but I'm not really confident about that. So anyways, there are a couple legitimate possibilities here of a hindrance that Moses felt that he had in accomplishing this task. Either way, God reminds Moses that he created man's mouth and grants the power of the senses, which, if Moses had a speech impediment, God would basically be reminding him, I gave you that, and I can control it. I can take it away if needed. But God reminds him that he created man's mouth, grants the power of the senses, then he promises to be with Moses and teach him what to say. Finally, in verse 13, Moses pleads that the Lord would just send someone else. Notice that it is not until this point that the anger of the Lord is kindled. Notice also, though, that even in his anger, God graciously gives Moses an answer and a solution to even this plea. His brother Aaron will be Moses' spokesperson, and God will be with them both and teach them both what to say and do. This is not as sometimes portrayed. This is not a God who condemns our questions or concerns, or doubts, or fear, or even initial unwillingness. Read the entire book of Psalms. This is a God who understands our frame, and who, even when exasperated, he is a God who is gracious and helps us. In fact, in these two chapters, we see that God sees, hears, knows, and cares about us in our time of need, both when we are suffering and when he asks us to do something that we feel inadequate to do. We also see that Christ, who inaugurated the new and greater covenant, is the same one who commissioned Moses, who inaugurated the old covenant. Just as he gave him a helper and promised to be with him and help him to know what to say, he has promised to be with us and has given us an even greater helper in the Holy Spirit, who continues the ministry of Christ and helps us to know what to say. Last week, we were reminded that God is faithful. This week, I want to encourage you that this faithful God knows your struggles and cares for you. This faithful God is the God of covenant love, who will never abandon his own. He is the God who will be with you and will help. He sees, he hears, he knows. He will act. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for this time to look at your word, to see your plan unfolding, to see your compassion for your people, to see your patience and your grace with Moses, to see that our deliverer, the bringer of the new covenant, was there all along as the covenants unfolded. I thank you that you have cared for us throughout all of history and that you continue to do so today. And I pray that this truth would be encouraging as we go into this week with our own struggles, our own fears, our own doubts, our own feeling of inadequacy, that we would know that you hear, you know, you care. And I thank you that you do. Amen.